Florida joined states across the country banning trans athletes from sports. Hello and welcome to Sundial on WLRN. I'm Luis Hernandez. Governor Ron DeSantis says he'll sign a controversial bill targeting trans athletes.
It just makes me sick to my stomach. We should be making progress. They're trying to send us backwards. They're trying to send my kid backwards.
We'll hear how it's impacting children's mental health. Plus, the old Colusa Country Club in West Kendall has become a popular open space since the course's operation stopped years ago. A developer wants to convert the space into more housing, and a protected bonneted bat is now at the center of it all. Finally, Fort Lauderdale's New River welcomes hundreds of thousands of visitors each year. We'll talk to the author of a new book about the river's long and, at times, headline-making history. All of that today on Sundial, after the news. The program is made possible in part by support from Miami Cancer Institute. Hello and welcome to Sundial on WLRN. I'm Luis Hernandez. Thanks so much for joining us today. Dozens of states across the country have bills preventing transgender high school and collegiate athletes from participating in women's sports. Last week, Florida became the latest, and now the bill awaits Governor Ron DeSantis. Supporters of the legislation have argued that trans women have an unfair physical advantage in sports relative to their cis female counterparts. Now, we invited the sponsor of the bill, Republican State Senator Kelly Stargell, to join us on the program today. She declined but provided a written statement, and here's an edited portion. We'll include a full statement on the website. Quote, "I have tremendous respect and empathy for children and families who are struggling with issues related to gender identity, which are particularly difficult in childhood. The legislation we passed ensures Florida protects the ability of girls and women to safely participate in athletics. In my view, we achieve that goal in a manner that respects the inherent dignity of each person, but also acknowledges the fact that the biological differences between men and women can be significant." End quote. LGBT plus advocates and Democratic state lawmakers say the legislation unfairly targets trans students. Kale Roberts identifies as queer and lives in St. Petersburg, Florida. They were afraid to open up about their identity playing sports in high school and college.
Makes me have a full body shiver and I have to hold back tears to make the answer because it's, I know how hard it is to find who you are as an outsider when already in school, let alone to be probed in this way that is putting these children in the limelight.
The bill could have major business implications for the state. The NCAA pulled its tournaments out of North Carolina following the passage of the discriminatory trans bathroom bill, and it's threatened similar action elsewhere. Earlier this morning, we spoke with reporter Daylena Miller out of WUSF in Tampa. Let's talk about how this bill passed. Many LGBTQ advocates thought the bill was dead 2 weeks ago. Then, all of a sudden, it's not. What happened?
So the transgender advocates I talked to are not surprised. So there was a lot of premature celebration, but there was so much debate for these bills in the beginning that they're not surprised that it was sort of snuck into this charter school bill as an amendment. And so, you know, that was the news late last Wednesday. A lot of the advocates that were there in person had sort of been ushered out of the building and previous committee meetings after they'd had their chance to speak, and they were pretty sure that it was a done deal. And you know, they had this sort of backdoor reintroduction and some changes, what they called compromises in the bill, where they took out the genital inspection part and instead they are going to be determining what they call biological sex by somebody's original birth certificate. So their birth certificate issued at birth, not, you know, not changed to match their gender identity.
Yeah. So this goes to the new bill's language, right? I mean, because I want to know explicitly what it says about transgender athletes participating in sports. Did anything change there?
So the bill says that transgender women and girls would effectively be banned from playing secondary school and college female sports teams under this bill, which was approved by both the House and the Senate. And so the language would determine a student's sex based on their original birth certificate, unlike the previous iterations of the bills, which would go by a doctor's inspection, which could include genital inspections.
So essentially any high school and college athlete. This pertains to them, right?
Right, just the high school and college athletes. It does not include elementary school students.
How is this bill different than the version before?
So the version before was mostly the genital inspections aspect. The biological sex was something that was determined by the doctor. So if a child's gender identity and sex were disputed, if they wanted to play on a team, they would have to go to a doctor and the doctor would have to produce proof that they were a biological female in order to participate in the athletic activities.
In Florida, have we seen recorded complaints or issues with transgender athletes in the past trying to play women's sports?
No, that's not a problem. Matter of fact, there have only been 11 children approved to play sports since 2013 that are transgender. And the high school and the college organizations that determine the rules for who can play have had for 10 plus years accommodations for transgender students.
Republican State Senator Kelly Stargell was behind this bill. What was the argument then the senator was making for having this now?
So the argument is that the argument is really that trans women are not women and trans men are not men. And so they believe that cisgender men and transgender women are naturally stronger and faster and therefore would be competing against cisgender women for scholarships. So that's not actually true, though, especially when these individuals are taking hormone replacement therapy, that they lose muscle mass and they actually become in terms of their body mass and their strength and their muscle mass actually become closer to somebody who'd be considered a cisgender female.
What's been the reaction from the trans community? Because as you said, there was sort of a celebration and then all of a sudden this happens.
The transgender community is absolutely horrified. I've talked to dozens of advocates and parents of transgender children, and they're absolutely beside themselves with grief and with frustration because it's so much more than kids playing sports. This is about the latest wave of attacks on transgender people. It was bathroom bills a couple years ago. Now it's these athletic bills. And so these advocates say that, these sports teach camaraderie, they teach teamwork, they teach so many things. Many of these children don't go on to become competitive. You know, a lot of them are not necessarily playing in college or they're not playing in professional sports after college. They're playing because they enjoy playing. And so you're taking that away from these children and you're telling them that they're wrong, is what these advocates say. You're telling them that they're bad, that they've done something wrong, and that their gender identity doesn't matter.
Let's hear from Heather St. Amand, a Pasco Pride board member who has a transgender child.
It just makes me sick to my stomach. It's just another obstacle that they're throwing up when we should be making progress. They're trying to send us backwards. They're trying to send my kid backwards.
So, Daylena, what's been the reaction from the parents of trans kids? What have you heard?
Parents of trans kids are pretty frustrated because they want their children to feel a sense of normalcy. They want them to be themselves. They want them to grow up to be normal little boys and normal little girls and, do the things that they want to do, just like cisgender children. And so a lot of these kids, these parents are telling me, are they're being targeted more in schools after these bills have been passed or proposed, and the ones that have spoken out have been bullied and have been harassed mostly by adults, not by other children. And so, they tell me that the kids in their classes accept them for who they are. They have no problem with them being out, in the ballpark, on the PE fields, on the basketball court. The parents are telling me that it's adults that have the problem.
Now, by the way, you've used the term cisgender a number of times, and I wanted to, let's define that for our audience, please.
So cisgender is if you identify with the sex that you were assigned at birth. So if the doctor told you that you were a female and wrote that down on your birth certificate and you identify as a female, then you are cisgender.
I'm speaking with Daylena Miller, reporter with WUSF in Tampa. A new bill sitting on Governor Ron DeSantis' desk would ban transgender athletes from participating in women's sports. You can find more details on the bill by going to our social media at WLRN Sundial. Now, this bill is not just a Florida thing. There's a national trend of these anti-trans bills. But what does this bill say about that larger national trend?
I think it's just they've sort of snowballed. I think that the legislators have seen that they've been proposed and successful in other states, and so they're trying to make it happen here. More than 200 bills in over 30 states have been proposed, a lot of them related specifically to trans athletics, some of them related to gender-affirming care from doctors in places like Texas. The bill has even, you know, proposed that parents should be considered child abusers if they affirm their children's identity. And so the advocates that I've talked to have just said this is the latest wave in the transgender attacks, and that they're trying to erase an entire generation. Because, you know, I think regardless of what side that you fall on, it's a very unfortunate thing that the homicide rate for transgender individuals has doubled in the past year. The suicide rates for transgender youths are astronomical. And so when advocates say when bills like these are proposed, even if they don't pass, the damage is already done. These children are already hearing that they're not worthy, that they don't have value, that their lives don't matter, that they can't get the health care that they need. And so, you know, and then when the bills do pass, they face these additional barriers to living a normal life.
And, you know, Delina, I wonder what lawmakers, what did they say to that when you talk about the impact this would have on transphobia and how those numbers continue to climb? I mean, did they have any response to that?
The same thing that the parents and the advocates had to say, that it was horrifying, that it was transphobic, that it was bigoted, that this was not about protecting women, that, you know, some lawmakers had even made the point that if it was about protecting women, that we would be processing rape and assault cases differently, because a lot of times the charges for those cases are not as strong as you would think for the crime, or, you know, women are afraid to even come to the stand to testify, you know, because a lot of times these men do get off and away with their crimes. So, you know, there was a lot of argument about, you know, the science of biological sex. And so some of the lawmakers, you know, talked a little bit about that. And so, but they're pretty much in alignment with you. It was very obvious who met with transgender families and children and who didn't. I was at a rally last night in Tampa against this bill. And one of the individuals who spoke, Nathan Broomer, who runs St. Pete Pride, which is one of the biggest pride organizations in the state.
When you are told you don't matter, the impact can be quite severe, and so we have to recognize that this piece of legislation has done damage, and we have to support each other.
Told me that, you know, even before they started talking to the Democrats and the lawmakers that are currently not supporting this bill, you know, that the Democrats didn't have the language, you know, and didn't have the ability to speak to these families and speak about these families and speak about the situation. So behind the scenes, transgender advocates had to do a lot of education about what it means to be transgender and what it doesn't mean to be transgender.
And I'm wondering, what do you mean about having that language? You're a trans-identifying person, so I wonder, what do you mean by not having that language? Help us understand.
So some pretty basic stuff like understanding why pronouns are important to people, what pronouns are, you know, how to use certain pronouns, because not everybody uses he or she, or, you know, and people like me use they or them. And then there are other sets of neo pronouns, or just understanding the challenges that these children, you know, go through, or understanding that children are not taking, hormone replacement therapy when they're 8 years old, you know, that puberty blockers that children might be taking are reversible. And so they give these children the opportunity to grow up and make permanent decisions about their bodies when they're older. And so a lot of people don't understand that puberty blockers are irreversible. A lot of people don't understand that, you know, these children are not having surgery. They're not, they're not having gender affirming surgery. They're not on, you know, HRT, you know, that they are just children living their lives who might be on puberty blockers until they can make a decision later in life.
Governor DeSantis has said that he will sign the bill. Do we expect any legal challenges?
Absolutely. Several groups, the ACLU, Southern Legal Counsel, several groups have told me that they are going to be challenging this, that it's unconstitutional, and that it goes against Title IX, and there are definitely going to be legal challenges down, you know, in the pipeline. Several groups have told me that. So I think we can expect that, you know, moving forward this year and into the next, that we're going to see those.
That was reporter Daylena Miller with WUSF in Tampa. You could read more of their reporting on Florida's trans athlete bill awaiting the governor's signature. Just go to our social media, WLRN Sundial. Well, still to come, an abandoned golf course, a housing project, and a protected bat. A development controversy only fit for Florida. Welcome back to Sundial on WLRN. Development and the environment. Sometimes it's a tough balance to make in South Florida. One of the latest controversies takes us to West Kendall and the Calusa Country Club. Now, the club has been closed down for a decade, and the land has become more of an open space, and a lot of people living around it love it that way. But the owners, Bacardi, want a new housing development. And now, in the middle of this battle over the land rights, the appearance of an endangered species, the bonneted bat. Joining us now is Amanda Prieto. She is a leader with the Save Calusa Neighbors Group, which is protesting the proposed development. Amanda, welcome to the program.
Thank you so much for having me.
Great to have you. And by the way, we did reach out to Bacardi and the real estate development company, GL Homes. They sent us a statement, which we will read throughout the conversation and also publish it on our website. Amanda, for a lot of us who haven't been around that area, kind of describe it for us. I mean, an old golf course that's kind of just turned into a natural space. Is that what it is?
Yeah. So what's special about our community is that it was developed as a golf course community back in the 1960s. So it's 168 acres of beautiful, tranquil green space. And the rest of the homes and community are really built around it. And there was actually a land use covenant protecting the space for 100 years until 2067.
So basically saying that the owners couldn't do anything with that except leave it as a golf course. But again, it was, I mean, the operations of that golf course ended years ago. So it's just been sitting there, right?
Yes. So it's been vacant for over 10 years. The owner actually sued the county and the homeowners. They lost on appeal. And then they negotiated a undisclosed private settlement with what we call the ring owners, which are the homes that back onto that golf course. So when they go to their backyards, they can visibly see the golf course. And with a certain number of signatures, they could release that covenant. So we had a public hearing for that last October.
Okay. And I want to talk about that. But so basically the developer had to make a new deal with the county, right? They had to basically, because again, they had to keep it a golf course until the year 2067, but they were able to get around that and say, no, we can build homes in the area now.
That's exactly right. And I think we as residents were really disappointed with that, because the whole intention of having a land use covenant is to protect the land and community. So people bought their homes and built their families in this community for a reason. And to have that all change so dramatically with such, you know, potential long-term effects could be devastating.
So we heard from Dick Norwalk. He is a vice president with the real estate development company GL Homes that wants to develop in the area. This is what he said, quote, "We have worked with homeowners surrounding the former Calusa golf course to conceive a community that will meet residential market demand while taking into account factors that include good environmental stewardship. We're excited for the opportunity to create a great community of homes in Kendall," end quote. This part of the, again, the statement that we received from them. So Amanda, the developer had to get some homeowners on board with this. You mentioned this just a second ago, and it's basically the people who live right there on the ring, right outside of the course. What did they do? They basically went to all of them and asked them, hey, are you okay with us building?
Slightly more complicated than that, because there was already ongoing litigation. So my understanding is they, after the litigation, several years of this, they presented an offer, negotiated a private settlement that included stopping all the ongoing litigation. But it also required that those people support this development and sign to release the covenant. So there are 146 homes around the golf course that we call the Ring Homes, and they obtained 123 signatures. But our entire community is, you know, 2,300 homes and residents that were never part of this negotiation and will be severely impacted by, you know, the impacts of this potential development.
Yeah. By the way, was there any money involved in paying any of those homes, those Ring Homes?
So it is a private settlement, so we aren't privy to it, and there is an NDA. But also, neighbors do talk to neighbors. And from what we've heard, you know, up to hundreds of thousands of dollars per home, and even additional land being promised if they signed this settlement agreement.
I'd imagine that's got to make things pretty tense in the neighborhood. I mean, because if you're all living next to each other, has that caused any rifts between neighbors?
Absolutely. It's very divisive. It's sad because this country club, you know, used to be the hub of the community. There used to be special events there, you know, weddings and parties, and you could go have lunch and golf. And it was such a positive attribute of our community. And to have it now resort to kind of vacant land that we're fighting over is really hard.
And just to make sure, by the way, too, is it because, it was a golf course, people enjoyed it, but then that stopped and that land just eventually, like any golf course that's abandoned, it turns into a natural open area. Everybody was okay with that, right? I mean, just that a golf course would be allowed to do that.
Absolutely. Yes. I mean, the importance of green space, particularly with the pandemic, you know, the quality of air, outdoor activities, you know, reducing traffic, but it being potentially critical habitat for wildlife, it just really affects our overall quality of life.
So this area now is zoned for 33 homes, but the developer has petitioned for 550 single family homes. What's your concern with that?
That's right. So it is still parks and rec land in terms of the CDMP, which comes with kind of additional hurdles that the developer will have to overcome when it goes to the county for zoning. But I mean, 550 homes, they would be removing specimen trees where potentially, you know, endangered species could be roosting. They want to fill the lakes. They are filling, you know.
Okay, I think I lost Amanda. Maybe the connection has gone. We're going to see if we can't reconnect. Amanda, you there?
I'm back.
Okay, all right. Not a problem.
I cut off. I'm so sorry.
No, that's okay. You know what, Amanda, let me push back a little bit here. You know, what if that development comes in and it raises the value of the homes in the neighborhood and makes your home more valuable?
I just don't see how that's possible because of the unique way that our community was developed. It's in the middle. You can't access it without going on local roads that were just not built to sustain the type of traffic that a large-scale development would create.
So we did hear from George Musa. He lives there with his wife and kids. He's been there since 1999. Let's take a listen.
During the pandemic, we all within the Calusa community realized how important green space is to our health and mind. We walked, we biked throughout the community and talked about how important it is for us to have public park in our community in Kendall. We also came in contact with wild animals that share our community, like the foxes and exotic birds that have called Calusa their home.
So Amanda, the pandemic has made us appreciate green open space a little bit more. How has having the country club impacted the community during this time? How did people use that area?
It is still private land, so given that they closed it, you know, the gates are physically closed, it's certainly not being encouraged to be actively used. But I think while it was dormant, it really kind of flourished in terms of natural habitat, in terms of the wildlife and the birds. We have a rookery, and there's, you know, multiple species of birds nesting right now in one of those lakes in the trees. So it's really just, you know, I've seen an increase in wildlife in general in the community. So I think, you know, certain aspects of it have actually flourished with it being closed.
We also heard from Mike Mills. He's been living in the area now since 1979. Let's take a listen.
I am very worried that elected officials do not realize how development on this property goes against their good intentions for our environment and to provide a good quality of life, not to mention safety and infrastructure issues.
So, Amanda, some residents not happy with how the county has handled the situation. You're located in unincorporated Dade. Do you think that's played a role?
I do, because, and especially since this is a zoning application, residents are really limited in how we can contact our county commissioners and ask for advice and help. In fact, we're really not able to. There's what's called the Jennings Rule, which limits conversations about zoning and requires that they be sunshined and open to the public. And we've had no opportunity to really express our concerns and talk about potential solutions with our government.
Again, I'm speaking with Amanda Prieto. She's the leader with the Save Colusa Neighbors Group, which is protesting the proposed development of the Colusa Country Club in the West Kendall area. Bacardi wants a new housing development, but it seems endangered bonneted bats have taken up in that space. Some residents are hoping that the evidence of the bats in the area might protect it from the development. Now, we did hear again from Dick Norwalk. He's the vice president with the real estate development company GL Homes. This is also part of his statement. He said, quote, "The bonneted bat is present over South Miami-Dade County, as well as parts of six other Florida counties. Our focus is on how to manage development and operate the site with protocols in place to sustain the native bat population. That includes consultations both with the county and U.S. Fish and Wildlife. GL Homes is a responsible steward that will operate the site in accordance with those protocols," end quote. And again, we'll make sure to put the full statement on the website. I want to bring in now Melky Gamarrios. He's a research fellow with the Bat Conservation International, and he worked on the research that found evidence that the endangered species is in the area. Melky, welcome to the program.
Oh, thank you for having me.
Melky, tell us about the bonneted bat and, first of all, why it's endangered.
Yes, sure. The Florida bonneted bat is an insectivorous bat. It's distributed in South Florida, and so that means that we only can find this species in these around 10 counties in South Florida, and have at least as an endangered species in 2013. This species roosts on cavities made by large woodpeckers in old pine trees, and small groups roost in there. So around 15 individuals can roost in these holes. And this has become an issue because they're losing the roost availability. And this is coming for two main reasons. One is we see an increase in frequency and severity of storms. So each year we have more hurricanes, and those hurricanes are destroying these pine forests. So that is an issue. The other issue is we have an increase in development trend. So we see that this is increasing, and the estimations in the next 15 years shows that we're losing a lot of habitats due to this highly development push, you know, that we have in the region.
Yeah. So, Melky, yeah. Do we know how many bats and how long they've been there?
No, we have records in Miami, you know, that the bats been using in the area or the urban environment since 1930. So we know that the bats live with us for a long time. Thanks to the invitation of Amanda and the residents, we installed two bat detectors on the backyards of some of the residents, and we detecting that the bats are using the space. But this is just a preliminary study, just a few weeks of data, and we submit a letter recommended that further study need to be done inside the golf course in order to really understand the possible impacts that the development can have on the species.
Amanda, where did the suspicion that there might be bonneted bats come from? Who was the first person to speak up about that?
Well, I think previously in some of the previous zoning applications, the county actually mentioned that, you know, former golf courses of this size in this area could be critical habitat, not only for the endangered bonneted bat, but for other species like the wood stork or the burrowing owl.
Melky, you said that you put a couple of, devices in some backyards to see if you could confirm that the bonneted bat was in that area. But don't you have to be in that area? I mean, I know it's closed off so that you can't get in there, but, do you have to try to get in there to try to be able to set up a really good study to see?
Exactly. In order to really have a good understanding of what is happening with the species in there, we need a more formal kind of a study inside the property. And that was one of our recommendations when we submit the information and the data that we collect on the backyards of the neighbors that are living in there.
And what do you need to determine whether the area has to be protected by the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service?
Well, there are different factors that can influence the decision. In general, one of the most important one is that the bats are using the trees in the property for roosting. And that is fundamental for this species to survive. So if the bats are roosting in there, I think that could be probably the most strong case for stopping any kind of development.
Okay. And the other thing, too, if someone suspects they have bonneted bats in their area, how can they help report?
Yes. We create a site for the project. The address is floridabonnetedbat.org. So in there, people can find information about the project, what to do if you have bats in your roof, in your property, and also a way to report so we can be in contact and we can visit and work with the community in order to help them to any problem that they may have, but also help to conserve the bats.
Yeah, Amanda, there are calls to put the project on hold, the development, so that there could be a formal survey of the area to really see if there's an issue here. Has the developer responded?
I'm not sure in terms of Fish and Wildlife. I haven't seen any documentation on the self-service zoning site yet. So at this point, we're just waiting to see, you know, I'm happy to see the statement from the developer. We're waiting to see what types of studies will be conducted and what the results are so we can better understand the utilization of the endangered species.
Yeah. Melky, you know, we saw this story not that long ago when we had Palm Beach County developers proposing Walmart. No, excuse me. Yeah, developers, they wanted to build a Walmart shopping center on Pine Rockland near Zoo Miami. Environmentalists sued but lost. How do you find that balance over the private property owner's rights and the environment?
Yeah, it's different, definitely tricky, you know, and definitely we are not against development. The thing that we need to find is a way to find a balance that helps the community and help also that the wildlife that live in these areas. I think around Zoo Miami, the issue is this is not private property, that is county property that the county sell. And probably that is one of the most difficult parts because the county have all of these areas that provide a service to the community where it's a win-win. So the people can use it during the day, enjoy these green spaces that, you know, increase the quality of life of all of us, but also during the night, the animals, the bats, and the wildlife can use those spaces. So for everyone, it's a win-win to maintain these open spaces and these natural areas inside the urban environments.
Amanda, briefly, where do you go from here? What's the next step?
I mean, our focus is to protect this green space and the wildlife and our residents' quality of life. So we have a website and a petition, and we're just asking to increase awareness and for people to support as best possible.
I want to thank my guest, Amanda Prieto, leader with the Save Colusa Neighbors Group, and Melky Gambarrios, research fellow with the Bat Conservation International. Amanda, Melky, thank you so much. I really appreciate it.
Thank you.
Thank you.
And by the way, you can find images of the Colusa Country Club and the wildlife there on our social media at WLRN Sundial. And listen, if you live out there, we'd love to hear from you. What are your thoughts about this issue? You know how you could do it? Through the text club, the Sundial Text Club. Just text the word hello to 786-677-0767. Again, just type hello to 786-677-0767. And in the future, you could tell us what you think about these kind of issues, and maybe we'll have you on the program. Well, still to come, from the Colusa Country Club, we head north to Fort Lauderdale, the New River, and learn its fascinating history through a new book.
Barrio La Cachimba se ha formado la corredera. En el barrio La Cachimba se ha formado la corredera. Allá fueron los bomberos con su...
Welcome back to Sundial on WLRN. I'm Luis Hernandez. Fort Lauderdale has been nicknamed the Venice of America for its endless waterways and canals connecting throughout the city. They all stem from the New River, which generates billions of dollars for Broward County through the boat show, Port Everglades, recreation, and a lot more. The history of the New River and how it's played an essential role in the development of South Florida is told in a new book, Legends and Lore of Fort Lauderdale's New River. It's available now in paperback. Author and former broadcaster Don Coley joins us now. Don, thank you so much. You know, reading this book, I was thinking about the first thing that hit me was, how much do locals and politicians actually know about the history of the New River that they probably see every day?
You know, that's, Lewis, thank you first of all for having me on the show. You know, that was one of the first things that I kind of thought about or realized when I started looking into this project. You know, we take for granted so many things that are in our communities. And it's not until somebody says, hey, why is the river called New? You know, why is this? What happened there? Why is Coley Hammock called Coley Hammock? That people start to think about it. And so what I found is that aside from members of the Fort Lauderdale Historical Society and others who helped me with research on the book, probably most people don't know much of its history.
You know, the origins behind the name of the Fort Lauderdale New River is fascinating, as you're touching on. Tell us a little bit of the story of, and I hope I'm saying this right, Himmershy?
Himmershy.
Thank you.
Very, very close. The one of the stories, one of the legends about the origins of New River comes from an Indian legend passed down over probably thousands of years to tribes way, way before the Seminoles were in Florida. And the legend is that the Indians were camped along what we now know as Fort Lauderdale, downtown Fort Lauderdale area. Was one of their camps. They had been out hunting and fishing for food and had gone to bed. And in the middle of the night, they were awakened with thundering noises and the ground trembling beneath their feet. They went back to bed and the next morning woke up to find a beautiful new river where before had just been land. And that was, they then called that Himmershy, which is supposed to be an Indian or a native word for new water, which the white men later translated into New River. So that legend, you know, is it true? I don't know if it's true.
I know. I was wondering, I mean, is there any reason to believe that there would have been, like, I guess, like what, an earthquake or something, some seismic activity that would have created a river overnight?
Well, that's exactly the theory that that geologists, first of all, this story was carried in the Fort Lauderdale Sentinel back in 1921 is when that story started becoming a little more known. But you're right. The, you know, to find out, I consulted with a geologist engineer who's very familiar with downtown Fort Lauderdale, having been involved in many of the major projects, the high rises that have been constructed there in recent years. And my question to him was, could this be true? And his opinion is that, yes, it could very well be true, because Fort Lauderdale and most of the coastal ridge, if you want to know, if you want to call it that, from, you know, the east coast of Florida, sits on top of a limestone ridge. And that limestone ridge in some areas, including some areas of downtown Fort Lauderdale, is only about 3 or 4 feet under the ground level that you come into this limestone. Limestone is very porous. It water travels through it very well. And over time, that limestone gets eaten away by the water. The engineer referred to it as like Swiss cheese.
Yeah.
So it becomes a little more brittle. And all it takes is some kind of an event to perhaps shake it loose. Now, as we know, earthquakes don't, Florida doesn't have many earthquakes, but we are earthquakes in other areas are often felt in Florida. I think it was January of last year that an earthquake south of Cuba actually shook buildings in Miami, and residents could feel that. So all it would take would be something that would happen some distance to cause that limestone to shift.
I mean, that's got to be a huge event. I wanted to ask you about this part of the history that's been disputed, and there's a personal connection to you. Tell us about what your understanding is of the Coley Massacre as it was taught to you and your connection to it.
My family immigrated to St. Augustine area in 1820. And since I can remember, the family has talked about the Coley Massacre, or as they pronounce it in St. Augustine, they pronounce the last name Cooley, the Cooley Massacre in Fort Lauderdale, where members of the family were massacred by a group of Seminole Indians. That story took on new life when it was memorialized by the city of Fort Lauderdale in the early 1920s. And a story evolved that members of the family had moved down to New River to establish a white colony on New River. And the Indians didn't like it, us taking over their lands and their hunting grounds. And they massacred members of the family. The story is too long to recite here, but there were things in that story that just never made sense, why members of the family from St. Augustine went down there. And the story was later debunked through some good journalism by reporters on the Fort Lauderdale Sentinel, but it never went away. And so one of my first reasons for looking into this was to find out whether it was true or not. The truth of the matter is that story was not true, but there is a story that is even more tragic that did happen on the banks of New River in 1836, just before the Second Seminole War. That story is recited in detail in there, and it is it's a really incredible story.
No, it's a fascinating story, and I would tell people, please check it out as you read the book, because it that story's been around for a while, and again, as you said, that finally it took a while before it was finally debunked, that true information finally surfaced on this. I'm speaking with Don Coley. His new book, The Legend and Lore of Fort Lauderdale's New River, it's available now. If you live in Broward County, we'd love to hear from your memories of the New River. You know, some of them, I think that our engineer said he got married in the park there. So everybody's got a little bit of memory of the New River. There's something that you connect with the New River. Let us know. You can find us on Facebook or Twitter at WLRN Sundahl, or email us sundahl@wlrnnews.org. Don, the success of Fort Lauderdale at the turn of the 20th century in large part is connected to its role as a trading port. How did Henry Flagler use the New River to bring in the produce and the goods and really help develop the area?
Well, Henry Flagler's contribution was huge to the entire east coast of Florida in that he built the railroad that connected the first way to get from north to south in Florida without having to take routes over over land or over water, which could be disastrous. The what happened is prior to that time, the people, Frank Stranahan and others who were living in Fort Lauderdale, established a very good trade originally with the Seminole Indians that were in the Everglades area. And they would bring in pelts and other things and exchange them at Frank Stranahan's trading post. That then evolved into, as the drainage of the Everglades started up with the intention of draining it all, it opened up a whole lot more farmland in the area of Davie and West. That farmland started to trade once again back through Stranahan's store and through the New River, where it connects to what now is the Intracoastal Waterway. That opened it up. And when Flagler's Railroad came in, it exploded, because then you had reliable, consistent transportation of all those goods, of all those farm products back up the coast all the way up to the big markets in the Northeast. And that really was the evolution of Fort Lauderdale. That and land sales. Because yeah. as more land became available, you have to remember that prior to that time, where today's I-95 is, that was the eastern edge of the Everglades.
Right.
So everything west of that was swampland. And so it was when the drainage project started that it started opening up all that land. There was a huge land lottery back in the early 1900s.
I got to tell you, that's something interesting. We talk about how far we keep pushing development on the Everglades. People need to remember the Everglades were right up there, very up close to the East Coast. You know, the other thing too is this, because I mentioned it earlier, is Fort Lauderdale is given that moniker, the Venice of America. Where did that come from?
Chamber of Commerce, most probably. You know, when landowners started getting together, or the business community in Fort Lauderdale started getting together and saying, okay, what can we do to maximize our real estate values? They realized that anything fronting the water is going to be more valuable. So where Coley Hammock is now, everything to the east of that was all swampland, mangrove swamps. So they started going in and dredging all of those canals, taking the dredge material to fill finger canals, and that is the properties today of Rio Vista and all of those beautiful communities that have 165 miles of canals, which is really unheard of. I mean, that's an incredible amount of canals.
Yeah.
And Chamber of Commerce said, let's call it the Venice of America, and it stuck.
And of course, you know, with sea level rise, it's going to become the Venice of America for many other reasons.
Well, sure. You know, I mean, that's for every movement, there is an opposite and equal reaction, right?
There you go. You point out something interesting. The river has a huge economic impact for the community. And it's not just like the port and the boat show. It's a lot of things. What are some of the other industries that have grown up around that?
Well, very interestingly, the marine industries is multifaceted. When we think of the marine industries, most of us, we think of the huge, beautiful marina facilities that are up and down the waterway, the big yachts behind people's homes. But there is a very active boat building, boat maintenance, construction facility out at the South Fork of New River, right about the I-95 pass overpass. That is world renowned. It's probably one of the top, I'm going to say top 10, probably higher than that, marine facilities, repair facilities. And that's most of those huge yachts that you see somehow squeezing through New River, through downtown Fort Lauderdale. That's where they're heading, out to the marine repair facilities to have, you know, work done on those huge mega yachts. Yeah. That's part of it. As you said, the boat show is huge. And the actual boat construction, even boat construction during the wars, there was a lot of the smaller vessels for the Navy and for the Army, landing craft and others, were actually built right there on the shores of New River at some of the boat yards.
It is a river that is there. It's a part of our lives. We don't think much of it, but it's such an important part of our lives, and it has such a fascinating history. And you can read about the history of the New River. It's in the book, the new book, The Legend and Lore of Fort Lauderdale's New River, by author Don Coley, available now. And again, we want to hear from you. If you live in Broward County, your memories of the New River, you can always find us on Facebook or Twitter at WLRN Sundial, or email us sundial@wlrnnews.org. Don, it has been such a pleasure. Again, just one of those things we don't think about enough, but it's a part of our lives. Maybe we should know a little bit about it.
Well, I think there's a lot to learn from the book, and hopefully told in a way that makes it easy to read and fun to read.
Absolutely. Don, thank you so much. I really appreciate it.
Thank you, Lewis.
And again, just to remind you, the title of the book, The Legend and Lore of Fort Lauderdale's New River, available now. Well, that's our program for this Wednesday, May 5th. Coming up tomorrow on Sundial, a familiar name is entering Florida's 2022 governor's race. Maybe you heard Charlie Crist has announced he's running again as a Democrat. We're going to learn about Crist's long political history in the state and how his candidacy shakes up next year's gubernatorial race. Plus, Luther Campbell has spent decades in Miami as a musician, activist, and community leader. He spent the past several decades working with high school students in Liberty City, developing players to enter the pros. Now Campbell has started his own sports management agency. We're going to speak with him about supporting black athletes in Florida. All of that coming up tomorrow on the program. Remember that we do have a book club, folks. You can always find us on Sundial's Book Club on Facebook. Just look up Sundial Book Club, ask to join. It is free. We'd love to have you. By the way, did we mention, I think I've mentioned a couple of times already, the book that we are reading for the month of May. It is Of Women and Salt by Gabriela Garcia. Check it out. If you're reading it right now, we'd love to hear your thoughts on the book. We'll be talking with her within another week and a half or so. So if you have questions for the author, you can always post them on Facebook. And I like to share those questions with the authors. They love to hear from you. I'm Luis Hernandez. Thanks again for listening. As always, be good to each other. Stay safe. The program is made possible in part by support from Miami Cancer Institute.